friends out there in Toronto. Welcome to CIUT 89.5 and 2 Animal Voices. On today's program, I'm really, really excited about this. We're going to be speaking with author Dara Lovitz about her most recent book, Muzzling a Movement: The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money, and Politics on Animal Activism. It's a short book that was put out by Lantern in their Flashpoint series, Books That Ignite the Mind. And essentially, it's a book that looks at the sort of lineage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, the cases that have been put forward under its various guises, and the money that's been involved in getting it to where it is. So I'm really looking forward to speaking with Dara about that at about the quarter past mark. But before that, of course, we get to some news. And the first bit of news coming to us today from Time.com. The headline is, "What's Killing the Animals at Ukraine's Biggest Zoo?" Samka the rhino looks sad. When her longtime companion Boy the elephant died in April, she watched over his body for an entire day until it was taken away. Today, the elephant's pen sits empty. Boy is just one of several animals at Kiev Zoo, including a camel, a bison, and a zebra that have died in recent months, some under mysterious circumstances. As the city carries out an official investigation, the deaths have prompted outrage and denial, with activists accusing the zoo of negligence and corruption, and authorities pointing to an anonymous killer as the culprit. Boy's death has brought fresh attention to a scandal that has been running for months. Serhii Georgiev, a former zoo worker who runs a site campaigning for the rights of the zoo's animals, says the Indian elephant was underfed, kept in poor conditions, and stressed by constant changes to the staff of handlers. Quote, "By the end, you could see his ribs," said Georgiev. According to animal rights activists, the number of animals at Kiev Zoo has almost halved in the past 2 years. They accuse the zoo's authorities of shoddy management, corruption, and neglect. The claims stretch into City Hall, with critics charging city officials of carrying out shady schemes to privatize the land on which the zoo is located in the center of the capital. The zoo's management denies the allegations, as do city officials. Many of the complaints focus on zoo director Svetlana Berzina. Critics accuse her and her associates of taking kickbacks and leaving the animals uncared for. Andrei Kapustin, head of the Expert Council, a civic organization chronicling animal welfare violations at Kiev Zoo, described it as a quote-unquote concentration camp in a May 26th article he wrote for the weekly Levi Bereg. Berzina denies all accusations of corruption and says she has been exonerated by numerous investigations. When questioned by Time about the mysterious deaths at the zoo, Berzina claimed that some of the animals could have been poisoned by quote-unquote opponents battling for control of the zoo. Boiled eggs, which were not part of Boy's diet, but were found in the elephant's enclosure after his death, could have been used to deliver poison, she says, as could a potato found with the camels. She even has a suspect, a man in his 40s with an earring. The Kiev police say they have no evidence of poisoning in Boy's case. The zoo's troubles reach back to before Berzina took over in 2008. The previous year, the zoo, once the largest and one of the best regarded in the Soviet Union, was thrown out of the European Association of Zoos and Aquaria because of concerns over animal welfare. A visit earlier this month reveals a zoo that has barely moved on from Soviet times, with its creaky old rides and small rundown pens and buildings. For years, Georgiev says the zoo has drained huge sums of money from the city budget, enough to build several zoos, he says, but improvements have been thin and incomplete. In May, city authorities finally responded to activist calls for action, suspending Berzina and forming an investigative committee to look into the mysterious zoo deaths. Meanwhile, City Hall has already washed its hands of any wrongdoing. In a statement, Mayor Leonid Chernovetsky appealed to, quote, "anyone involved in the animals' deaths in any way to stop using our innocent little brothers as a stake in your cruel games." But activists and opposition politicians say the mayor, who appointed Berzina to run the zoo, is the biggest part of the problem. In his Levi Bereg article, Kapustin suggests the animals' deaths may be a ploy by city authorities, in cahoots with the zoo's management, to reduce the zoo's animal stock and provide an excuse to move the zoo from the gold mine that is the 84 acres of land it sits on. Opponents have long accused Chernovetsky and his team of giving away tracts of land to family and associates in sweetheart deals. council offices were raided in early July by the State Security Service as part of an investigation into irregular land deals. City Hall declined to comment to Time regarding the claims, although officials have publicly denied allegations of improper land privatizations. And you can read a little bit more from that article if you go check out time.com. The next story coming to us from CBS4News.com. The headline is Arrest Made in Sheepskin Factory Fire. Now, just some background on the story. There was a sheepskin factory in Utah that was burned to the ground. And for a while, there was nobody who claimed responsibility. But then, after a few weeks, someone came forward and said that they were an Animal Liberation Front activist and claim responsibility for the fire. So this is related to that story. CBS 4 News has learned that an arrest has been made in the April 30th arson fire at the Sheepskin Factory on Colorado Boulevard in Glendale. A man from Utah, Walter Bond, was taken into custody in Denver by federal law enforcement authorities. Previously, a person associated with the Animal Liberation Front claimed responsibility for setting the blaze, and another in Utah at a leather store. Investigators say Bond told a friend that he started the fire, as well as two other fires in Utah that destroyed businesses he deemed were cruel to animals. Court documents say Bond has the word vegan tattooed on his neck. In June, CBS4 reported a claim was posted on animal rights websites that the fires were set, quote, in defense and retaliation for all the innocent animals that have died cruelly at the hands of human oppressors. It was signed Lone Wolf. Quote, it gave us a significant lead we could follow up on. It gave us a direction, nickname, and moniker we could track, Glendale Police Chief Victor Ross said. Bond has not been charged in the other fires. He allegedly told the friend that he started the fire that destroyed the leather factory in Salt Lake City in June and the Tiburon restaurant in Sandy, Utah, which served foie gras. The fire in Denver destroyed the store, which sells products made from sheepskin. The owners say their company was not involved in cruelty to animals in any way. And the final story today coming to us from telegraph.co.uk. The headline is Beer to be Sold in Dead Animals. A British 500-pound a bottle super-strong ale is to be sold inside the bodies of dead animals. The stunt has been condemned by animal rights groups as cheap marketing tactics. 12 bottles of the End of History ale have been made and placed inside 7 dead stoats, 4 squirrels, and 1 hare. And at 55% volume, its makers claim it's the world's strongest beer. A taxidermist in Doncaster worked on the animals, which were not killed for bottling the new drink, with some having been killed on the roads. Outfits featured on some of the animals include a kilt and a top hat. Brewdog of Fraserburgh, Aberdeenshire, created the ale, which is stronger than whiskey and vodka. The brewer recommended the beer should be served in a shot or whiskey glass, quote, to be enjoyed like a fine whiskey. The firm's co-founder, James Watt, said, quote, in true Brewdog fashion, we've torn up convention, blurred distinctions, and pushed brewing and beer packaging to its absolute limits. This is the beer to end all beers. It's an audacious blend of eccentricity, artistry, and rebellion, changing the general perception of beer one stuffed animal at a time. The impact of the End of History is a perfect conceptual marriage between taxidermy art and craft brewing. The bottles are at once beautiful and disturbing. They disrupt conventions and break taboos, just like the beer they hold within them. End quote. The Blonde Belgian Ale, infused with nettles and juniper berries, was created by Brewdog's brewers by freezing the liquid to separate water from the solution. The process was repeated dozens of times, requiring hundreds of liters of beer to be reduced through the process to produce just enough for a 330ml bottle. Brewdog drew criticism from industry watchdog the Portman Group last year when it unveiled a 32% beer, Tactical Nuclear Penguin. It has also faced claims that its 18.2% Tokyo beer promoted excess. In February, the firm launched Sink the Bismarck, a 41% volume ale. The End of History can be bought through the Brewdog's website. But animal campaigners and others hit out at Brewdog's latest offering. Ross Manette, campaigns director for the charity Advocates for Animals, said, quote, using shock tactics to get attention is terribly out of date, especially when this involves exploiting or degrading animals. The modern approach is to celebrate the wonders of animals and respect them as individual sentient creatures. I'm sure this would have much greater appeal with the animal-loving public. We will be getting in touch with BrewDog to advise them on what people today really think about animals and how a positive, caring approach and appreciating live animals is the best way forward. Barbara O'Donnell, Director of Services at Alcohol Focus Scotland, said, quote, "This is another example of this company pushing the boundaries of acceptability, all in pursuit of cheap marketing tactics." However, Mr. Watt argued that criticism of the beer's high strength was totally misguided. He said, quote, "This artisan beer should be consumed in small servings whilst exuding an endearing pseudo-vigilance and reverence for Mr. Stout. The real catalysts for binge drinking culture are not well-crafted beers, but the monolithic corporate machines that have cultivated a culture of quantity rather than quality." He also responded to criticisms of the packaging of the product and stated, quote, "I can think of no grander way to celebrate these animals than for them to be cherished by the lucky owners. The animals used to bottle the end of history all died of natural causes. Better to be celebrated and valued than left to rot." That, my friends, is the news for this week. As always, weird. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM, and today I am speaking with Dara Lovitz. She is the author of Muzzling a Movement, The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money, and Politics on Animal Activism. I'm really, really glad that we're doing this show. You know, we've talked with many other guests who have been involved in animal liberation, Rod Coronado, Peter Young. We've also talked with people who have more of a specialization in terms of the law surrounding animal activism, like Will Potter. But I don't think that, even though we've done that quite a bit, I don't know that we do it enough justice in general. So I'm really glad to have Dara on the program. Dara is the author of Muzzling a Movement, The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money, and Politics on Animal Activism. She is an adjunct professor of animal law at both Temple University Beazley School of Law and the Earl Mack School of Law at Drexel University. Lovitz was appointed special prosecutor by the Lancaster County District Attorney to prosecute the pivotal Pennsylvania case Commonwealth v. Esbenshade, in which the Elizabethtown District Court determined the criminal liability of a battery cage egg production facility owner and supervisor under Pennsylvania's animal cruelty statute. Lovitz is legal chair for the Pennsylvania chapter of the Sierra Club, a board member of 4 Feet Forward, an organization that helps grassroots animal advocacy organizations with their legal and media campaigns by offering services at no cost, and a board member of Peace Advocacy Network, an organization that promotes veganism, social justice, and respect for the Earth's inhabitants and resources. Lovitz has written extensively in law journals and trade publications on various animal law topics and frequently presents topics of animal law in television, radio, and podcast segments, as well as conferences across the country. It's my great pleasure to welcome someone with such a long list of accolades. Dara, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm sorry you had to read such a long list. Did I give you that? I don't think so. I hate the long intros myself, but thank you. I appreciate being here, actually.
You're welcome. I wanted to ask you a question that we ask of all of our guests right off the top, and that's a question of how you got into animal issues.
When I was 11 years old, I was brought to an airport to protest the transportation of monkeys in crates. It just shows how young I was, because I don't understand the issue at the time. And I don't know why my friend's mom brought us there, but we were at the airport for this protest, and I guess somebody was tabling and had pamphlets that showed images of animals in factory farming conditions. And that convinced me to go vegetarian. And I just didn't know about dairy and eggs and the cruelties involved in the dairy and egg industry until I was... even out of law school, I was doing some pro bono work on the Esbenshade case about egg-laying hens. And then I learned about the entire egg industry and the dairy industry, and I was actually kind of shocked that it took me that long to come to the realization, because my reasons for going vegetarian had nothing to do with health or the environment. It's purely ethics. And it never occurred to me that dairy and eggs came from the exploitation of animals or the suffering of animals. It just didn't. It's like something I hadn't thought of, and I'm kind of disappointed in myself also, because I consumed so much dairy and eggs when I was a vegetarian. It was It was something, you know, almost every meal, I think, had one or the other in it. So I feel like I contributed a lot to the exploitation and the suffering of animals just by being a vegetarian. So that's how I ended up at veganism. And then, you know, obviously animal rights was all a part of it, and I became heavily involved in the animal advocacy movement, different organizations, and participating on a pro bono level as a lawyer and then as an activist.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you actually what inspired you to take up, it seems that you've taken up law practice as a key form of activism. And so I know there's, you know, some debate within the movement about whether or not law practice is the best way to go about making changes. So what inspired you to take up law as a form of activism?
I thought it was sort of, I thought it was the only way to make changes, and it's something that I decided when I was in high school, that I saw my father was an attorney, I watched the movies and the TV shows, and it seemed like you could really affect change by being a lawyer on a significant level, or you could be a politician, and I just don't think I'm cut out for being a politician. So I saw those as my two options. In getting to know the grassroots level of activism, I don't think that's the case anymore. I'm not saying it's not. I'm saying there's so many forms. And I really, if anybody asked me for advice, how can I be the best advocate for animals, I'd say find out what your strengths are and use them. If your strengths are cooking, then open a vegan restaurant. If your strengths are organizing, then organize demonstrations. You know, I just think everybody has different skills, and we need to use our strengths and go in that route. So if you're a good writer, if you love writing, then write a lot of pieces and try to get published in non-animal rights journals on animal issues. So I just think everybody should really go where he or she is suited based on his or her interests and strengths. And I think for me, maybe I liked arguing, or I liked the thought process, or I liked public speaking. Something about law appealed to me. So it's where I went, and it's where I'm stuck. So to speak, I'm here.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways that you used your skills in law was in the case with Commonwealth versus Esbenshade, and that was that's a case that's talked about in a little bit of detail in the book, and it seems to have been quite a turning point for you personally. So I'm wondering if you could give our listeners a bit of an overview of what that case was about and how it affected you.
The Esbenshade case was brought about based on an investigation done by a Compassion Over Killing investigator who applied to work at the Esbenshade Battery Cage Facility, which is just a huge egg facility. And he worked there for a couple of months, and with his undercover video camera, he documented several forms of suffering. And the point of that was to meet the standards of the animal cruelty law in Pennsylvania so that we could then bring a criminal prosecution of the supervisor and the owner of the egg-laying hen facility. And after a lot of footage, we accumulated, I think, 35 counts of animal cruelty against both the supervisor and the owner of the egg farm, and brought the criminal prosecution case. And it was very interesting. It was interesting to go through the law in Pennsylvania and see that there really isn't much to protect farm animals. Just like most states across the country in the United States, Pennsylvania also has what's called a common farming exemption. So basically the law says everything, you know, from mutilating to neglecting to maliciously enforcing suffering on an animal, all of that is animal cruelty unless it's part of normal farming operation. And in Pennsylvania, the language is normal agricultural operation. So it's an exemption for farm animals, which constitute most of the animals on our earth. And they're just not protected at all under our animal cruelty laws. But we thought that we could show that this was abnormal. There was nothing normal about this farming, about this kind of farming against the egg-laying hens. So we tried to undo the exception. And it was an interesting lesson in politics in Lancaster County in Pennsylvania. It's a very farmer-heavy constituency, and the judge was a magistrate, district judge, justice. She was elected every 2 years by her constituents, and it's almost not surprising that she acquitted the defendants and didn't find them guilty. It really wasn't surprising. We just thought everything was so strong. We made such a strong case. And she was compelled by the video footage. We were able to show all the video footage, which was obviously an argument. The defendants didn't want us to show that. But we won that motion, and we showed the video footage. And you could see on the judge's face she was really being affected by what she was seeing. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, she did not convict these defendants.
And so one of the key things that you discuss in this first section of the book is that laws are inadequate to protect animals, and that animal liberation arises from a frustration with the fact that there are there's simply a lack of sort of legal recourse in cases of animal cruelty. And some of the things that I wanted to highlight, or I was hoping that you could explain, were things like burden of proof and trying to prove criminal intent in terms of things like animal cruelty. I think, you know, for a lot of people, they see videos of, you know, a compassion over killing investigation video, and they think, well, obviously this is horrific, but when it comes to actually proving that a farmer did something intentionally, it's not so easy to prove, is it?
It's not, because it looks like what the courts would call neglect, but simple neglect, you know, oh, it happens, you have billions of animals on your farm, it's going to happen, it's, you know, these things happen, these things fall into place. It's hard to say that somebody, you have to go deep into the recesses of their mind and say they intended to do the harm and they intended for the damage to occur. And I think in a lot of cases that's just not able to be proved. So it's a high standard to prove intent and malicious actions. I think that in cases where you see somebody beating a pig or throwing a turkey across the room so it hits a wall and falls to the ground, that looks more like an intentional act. But when you just see animals stuffed into cages and it's a mess and they're standing in their own feces, that just looks like neglect. It looks like negligence. It looks like they're just, you know, letting it go. It's different. It's a different kind of intent. And each state has its own definition or its own case law to help somebody understand what intent is and whether it was malicious or not and knowingly doing something. It's all defined by the state's own case law. But yeah, that makes it difficult. Like I said, the common farming exemption makes it difficult as well. And I kind of agree with Gareth Francine on the fact that we have animal cruelty laws. It's sort of making legitimate the idea that animals are our property, something to treat in a certain way. And that's the problem too. So I guess my first chapter was really trying to say exactly what you said. Because the laws fail animals, we have to do something else. And that's why activism is so important on so many levels. And right, animal liberation arises out of this frustration that we have an entire legal system with hundreds of years of precedent, and it just doesn't work.
I wanted to ask you a bit of a devil's advocate question related to that, because you make the argument that animal liberationists are frustrated with either the lack of legal means or the fact that the legal means of recourse in terms of animal cruelty are not adequate and result in, you know, very small penalties. I'm guessing that some people at home listening or people listening in their cars who are tuning in and who don't necessarily have an understanding of this situation might say, well, do you really think that all animal liberationists have tried legal means first? Or have they just gone straight to the sort of more militant actions? Do you think that that's relevant?
No, not at all. I don't see what the point is. When you have a system, a legal system that has failed you time and time again, and you know there's no chance in bringing a case and being successful to free the animals, it makes no sense for me to say, well, if you didn't try the legal methods first, or you didn't try to do everything by the law first, then your form of activism it's too rash, it's too extreme. I just think that's ridiculous. I think in our movement it's important that we have people trying to make the laws work for us, and we have plenty of groups, as you know, who do that, and they'll bring animal cruelty cases, and I think that's wonderful. I think it's also wonderful that we have part of a movement that sees that the law isn't working and tries other things that might be considered more extreme. It's all part of bringing about change, and it's happened in the civil rights movement. You have Malcolm X and you have Martin Luther King Jr. Without either of those ends of the spectrum, I don't think change would have happened the way it did or as quickly as it did. And I think they're both important forces in the movement, so I think it's fine that they haven't tried the legal means. There are plenty of other people in the courts right now spending a lot of money and spending a lot of time in front of judges, and we also need the people on the front lines as well.
Tara, we need to take a very short break to play a station ID, and then we will come right back if you'd like to stick around.
I'll be here. Thanks.
Great. We are speaking with Dara Lovitz, author of Muzzling a Movement. The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money, and Politics on Animal Activism. It's out on Lantern Books. In their Flashpoint series, we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back on Animal Voices. If you have any questions or comments about this show, please do drop us a line, animalvoices@gmail.com. Or, if you'd like, you can check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. We've got over 300 archived shows available for free download. Check them out. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Before the break, I was talking with Dara Lovitz, author of Muzzling a Movement, The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money and Politics on Animal Activism. And we were talking about her background as an animal activist, as a animal lawyer, and briefly some of the issues that surround animal law. I'd like to ask you now, Dara, if we could get into, I guess, the history a little bit of the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act and move all the way back to the Farm Animal and Research Facilities Protection Act. I had heard of the Animal Enterprises Protection Act before, but wasn't aware that there was actually a law that sort of preceded it, or an act that preceded it. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about that act and who the sponsors were.
Well, there were a couple. Sensenbrenner is one of the main ones. But yeah, that act originated out of a whole series of different congressional hearings about eco-terrorism in general, which was originally defined by quote-unquote environmental radicals, and then they added animal activists to that list. So eco-terrorists became environmentalists as well as animal rights activists. And when I trace the history of the congressional hearings that eventually led up to the Animal Enterprise Protection Act and Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act that started with these other eco-terror laws, it seemed to be directly related to the increase in animal liberation activities across the country, and specifically fur farm raids and break-ins at laboratories, vivisection laboratories.
For our listeners, yeah. could you let us know the time frame of this roughly?
As early as the late 80s is when it seemed to be the increase in activity, as well as the congressional hearings. And as the animal liberation activities increased, it seems like the language of these laws that kept getting passed became more and more restrictive of animal rights activism. And it's you know, at first it started out with animal rights extremists, and then the language is animal rights radicals, and then now it's animal rights terrorists. Mm-hmm. So even the language, the labels that they use to describe animal activists had changed and became more extreme, again, as more and more damage was being done by animal rights activists against different industries, specifically the pharmaceutical and animal agriculture industries.
Now, how did that act morph into the Animal Enterprises Protection Act?
Well, like I said, the language has kept getting more and more restrictive at the hearings, and they felt like because the actions were increasing, obviously the Farm Animal and Research Facilities Protection Act, that must not have been strong enough. So they kept having to add teeth to the language of the statute. And as they did that, sometimes they would change the name, sometimes they would just amend the statute under the same name, but eventually it became the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And then, again, they needed to add more teeth because people were still out there causing a lot of financial damage and property damage to animal industries. So then they changed it to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and really gave it a lot of strength and a lot more restrictions on animal activism. And even the word, you can even tell the difference between the word protection and terrorism. You know, mm-hmm. It's like the first time it's just protecting the animal enterprise, but now it's charging the criminals, in quotes, with a crime of terrorism. It has a whole extra chilling effect.
I wanted to read a statement from Senator Patrick Leahy. Basically, they were having a hearing about this act, and he refused to attend and submitted a statement in which he expressed approval that the hearing's original title, quote, "The Threat of Animal and Ecoterrorism," had been abandoned, and he wrote, quote, "Most Americans would not consider the harassment of animal testing facilities to be terrorism any more than they would consider anti-globalization protesters or anti-war protesters or women's health activists to be terrorists. I think that most Americans would rather that we address more urgent concerns that really do pose a serious threat to this country and to the world." He also noted that although he had suggested to Chairman Hatch to include an additional witness at the hearing who would balance out the proceedings with a different perspective on the issue, Chairman Hatch had declined to do so. Do you think that his opinion is actually reflective of the American public perception?
I would like to think so. I would like to think so because he is not significantly connected with the animal rights communities. He is just a politician who happened to see how ridiculous all these hearings were. So I would like to think that he has a really good finger on the pulse of the American people and what most people would consider acts of terrorism or what people wouldn't. And I like the fact that he mentioned those other groups, women's health groups, and because that's the whole point of this law, is that it specifically targets one political movement. And, you know, it doesn't target any other movement. And that's viewpoint discrimination, and it's completely prohibited by the Constitution. And I think by referencing these other movements, he was obviously telling everybody, in his own words, this is unconstitutional because it's targeting one particular group. If you don't have a problem with these other groups and their messages, you shouldn't have a problem with this group and this message, and it just can't be terrorism if the same actions by another group wouldn't be terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that he did this, and I love the fact that, again, he's not significantly connected. You don't think of Patrick Leahy and think, oh, he's an animal rights activist, he's a vegan. He just doesn't identify with the movement at all. So the fact that he said it, and in those same hearings, we have then-Senator Barack Obama also saying the same kinds of things, like really focus on real terrorists, not environmentalists, not animal rights activists. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really great language. I think all of those quotes, Frank Loudenberg was another one, Senator Loudenberg. I mean, there was some really good language in there from, again, politicians who were not connected with the animal rights movement at all.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the sponsors of the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act? Because I think that this is something that we haven't really covered a whole lot before, and I think it's definitely worth talking about. There were two key sponsors, correct?
Yeah, there were a couple. I think Senator James Inhofe is an interesting one. He is known by Americans as having said that global warming is the greatest hoax perpetrated on the American people. So a lot of environmentalists take issue with him. He also owns, I think, $250,000 in energy-related businesses like gas and oil industries. So he's not a friend to the environmentalists, and nor is he a friend to the animal rights movement. In fact, most of his money came from contributions from the animal ag industry, significant contributions. On the other side of the aisle, we have a Democrat, Charles Stenholm from Texas, and he also is heavily supported by the animal ag industry. And co-sponsoring the bill, I'm sorry, was another Democratic senator, was Dianne Feinstein, and her husband is CEO of the C.B. Richard Ellis Group, which is a large commercial real estate firm dealing with clients like Novartis and Wyeth and just huge pharmaceutical companies there. And in the book, I just point out that their top contributors were from industries that would love to see animal rights activists silenced because these industries are suffering financially because of actions, animal liberation actions and other forms of activism. So there's a real connection between the money and the politics, I think.
Mm-hmm. It seems that the issue of vivisection is one that continuously comes up, and that it seems like the biggest sort of... Well, obviously, the most well-known convictions have fallen under organizations that combat against vivisection. And on pages 58 and 59, you describe in great detail, and I won't go into it here, but for anyone who picks up the book, you detail very specifically why animal testing is more or less a failure in a lot of ways, and yet it seems to be one of the most highly... protected industries, or the industries that seeks so much protection from activists. Is there a particularity to that industry that makes it, one, more of a target, and two, that it wants more protection than other industries?
I think it's a couple of things. I think it's, number one, the workers in the industry happen to be doctors, researchers, scientists, and I think in our country we hold those positions and those work descriptions in a higher regard than others, than factory farmers or than fur farmers. I think we just hold them in a higher regard, so maybe we want to protect them more. This is all speculation, by the way. Another thing is the rhetoric coming out of the industry. It's all they say in their hearings is that they're working on the cure to cancer and the cure to AIDS, and they're working on these life-saving, that's the word they always use, the life-saving techniques of these researchers. Mm-hmm. And they're making it legitimate for the American public, because who doesn't want to find a cure to cancer, and who doesn't want to end AIDS? And so it's they're appealing to really sensitive areas in Americans' lives, and because they're using that kind of rhetoric, people don't hear the other side, and people don't consider the other side, which is that they'll kill millions, billions of animals before coming across anything that's substantially helpful in science and substantially progressive. And there's so many other ways, non-harmful methods that you can use. But people don't hear that side of it. All they hear is that there was a cure for this, or that they found a way to figure out that mice don't become obese if they don't have a pleasure signal triggered in their brain. You know, it's, what they're learning about is animals. They're really not learning about humans. Or what I should say is they're learning about non-human animals. They're not learning about human animals in all this research and all this killing that they're doing. So I guess you just really don't get that other perspective, which is why I love the group PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, because they have so many scientists and doctors on the staff who sell all those myths and basically give the science behind it, which is helpful. It's one thing for me, a lawyer, to say that that's not good science. But when you hear scientists say that's not good science, there's obviously more strength in that statement. And I think that group is great because they're really the loudest voice out there that's countering all the claims that what the researchers are doing are life-saving techniques.
The Shaq 7 case is obviously the sort of biggest case study in the book. So I did want to talk about that, even though we have covered it on the show in different ways before. What I think is especially interesting in your book about the coverage of the case is then the subsequent discussion of the sort of constitutional implications that the case raised and that the law that was applied in the case raises. One of the things that I learned about the case that I didn't know before was that the prosecution seemed to hinge a lot of their case, especially their case against Lauren Gazzola, on this pronoun we. Can you describe why her use of the word we in different communications helped to convict her?
Yes, and when she said we, I can't say what she was referring to, but there's obviously a possibility, and this would be enough to raise reasonable doubt, that she was just saying we as a movement, we as a group, but not necessarily that we as this particular group or we as in I personally did anything. So when she would say we effed them up, referring to significant financial damage or holding demonstrations, anything that she said when she used the pronoun we, again, she could have been referring generally, but when the prosecution presented it, it was more of as though it were an admission, a pure admission of guilt. And the other thing that's important in the Shaq case is this conspiracy charge. So even if they don't show that that Lauren, for instance, did anything, that they if they don't have a video footage or any proof that she did anything illegal, if she participated or acted in furtherance of doing something illegal, she could be committed under this conspiracy charge, which is another reason why that pronoun we could really... because nonetheless, she could be part of a conspiracy to do those acts.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be another we here, and that is, and this is something else that I learned in this book that I was so thankful that you talked about, which is that the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act actually protects third parties. So, for example, with Huntington Life Sciences, Shaq targeted companies that invested in Huntington Life Sciences or supplied them with toilet paper or things like that. And so one of the things that I didn't know was that the AETA protects third parties, and that seems to be a direct targeting of protest actions like boycotts and divestments.
Yeah, right. Tertiary targeting, as it's called, third-party targeting, was really effective for Shaq because they caused a lot of financial damage once the investors started pulling out and saying, oh, I don't want to deal with this, and they would pull their money out of HLS, HLS started to sink financially. So it was a really effective method of activism, is this tertiary targeting or third-party targeting. And, right, so the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, in its amended form, protected even family members of the people that were investors. So it's even a step further. It's not just the investors themselves. So it wasn't HLS, the enterprise. It was the people who invested in the enterprise were also protected. And then the people who are related to the people who invested in HLS were protected. So once you broaden that scope of who's protected under the statute, it's almost impossible not to violate it if you're trying to do any kind of tertiary targeting. You're going to cause some kind of property damage or make someone feel fearful, whether it's the 7-year-old of the person who invests in HLS or provides insurance or whatever. So it's just one more example of the broad language of the statute and how it was made so all-encompassing that almost anything you could do could wind you up in court at least.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, when we talk about things like freedom of speech, I mean, obviously there are limits to freedom of speech, and And you talk about the sort of utilitarianism of freedom of speech in the sense that, you know, if a particular kind of speech causes more damage to the community than good, I guess, that it's not protected under freedom of speech laws. But one of the things that seemed particularly troubling to me about your discussion of freedom of speech in relationship to these laws is the sort of undercurrent of speciesism that goes underneath it, because other movements involved in other issues don't face these kind of limits on what they can say and what they can't say about certain companies or certain organizations that work against their activist goals. Also, in terms of the discussion of equal protection, there's this undercurrent of speciesism in that people who are involved in animal activism in particular are seen as more of a threat to society at large.
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning before, the viewpoint discrimination, and it's probably what I find most offensive about all of this. It's basically saying that the animal rights activist message is one that should not be heard. Whereas if you were doing the same things on behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, or the NRA, or the Tea Party, or the Democratic Party of your county, I mean, any other activist group doesn't have the same restrictions because their messages are deemed acceptable, or at least workable, by the government, and the government perceived the animal rights movement as such a threat that they had to restrict our message. And I think it has to do with the money, animal agriculture, pharmaceutical industries. They are so powerful. They're such powerful industries, and nobody wants to hear that they've been damaged or harmed in any way. They just receive this extra level of protection that other industries don't seem to receive. And it just seems, it's definitely rooted in speciesism, it's rooted in carnism, it's rooted in deep-held belief that we should be eating meat and we should be eating animal products, and that the human versus animal relation is one of dominion, and that we use animals for our own good. We clothe ourselves with them, we eat them, we use them so that we can find life-saving cures to diseases. So it's that those deeply held beliefs that seem to fuel this idea that the animal rights message shouldn't be heard. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I agree with you. I think speciesism is really the root of it all.
You get into a discussion after that about the definitions of terrorism, the various and multiple definitions of terrorism that exist out there. And I know it's to some degree an academic discussion about what is the definition of terrorism, but you talk about the separation of, because many definitions of terrorism, it seems, relate to innocent people, you know, the terrorizing of innocent people who aren't necessarily, I'm not sure if this word is ever used in the book, but they're not necessarily combatants. They're sort of civilians, regular people who are not involved in the issue at hand. And you argue that many terrorism scholars would probably not consider the people who have been targeted by groups like Shaq to be innocent. I imagine that some people sitting at home would be saying, well, but aren't their kids innocent, or aren't they innocent in a way? It's a devil's advocate question. I'm just wondering if you can respond to it.
It's a great question because, like you said, from their perspective, they haven't done anything wrong and they're acting perfectly legally by cutting into animals and causing them to suffer. I mean, there's nothing in the laws that says that that's bad or that that's illegal. And there's nothing in society except for us who tell them that that's a bad thing. So you're right. In a sense, they are innocent in that sense. But again, there are so many other aspects to the definition of terrorism that make what animal liberationists and animal rights activists do not it. Mainly that violence is a necessary component of terrorism. And animal rights activists and vegans, we espouse nonviolence and ahimsa. Even the Animal Liberation Front, in their guidelines, they say don't cause harm. They say it more eloquently than this, but don't cause harm to anybody, human or non-human. And so nonviolence is a necessary component of animal rights activism, whereas violence is a necessary component of terrorism. And on that alone, the analogy suffers. And then there are other things. There are other aspects of terrorism, like I mentioned in the book, the conspiratorial cell structures and targeting people, not property, animal rights activism. While a lot of animal liberationists have no problem destroying property, they, again, do not harm human beings. They do not intend to harm human beings. So I think there are several other distinctions. But I agree with the statement that, in a sense, and at least from their own perspective and from the general society's perspective, vivisectors are innocent. And I put that in quotes.
Mm-hmm. The book ends, from my perspective, on a pretty grim note about the shack restitution. And this is, I think, something that maybe a lot of us in different AR circles have kind of forgotten, is that shack started with the intent of shutting down HLS, and the, you know, the sort of action in doing so would be to cause as much economic damage as possible until HLS was unable to function. But in the end, because of these convictions, the Shack 7 are facing a restitution bill of around $1 million to pay back damages that they've caused. I guess the end of the book makes the point is that these laws do go very, very far to put in a chilling effect into activism, but I'm wondering if you see any possibilities for resistance, or what you do see are the possibilities for resistance when the stakes are so high.
Well, I didn't mean to bring you down, but
no, I mean, it's okay. I bring myself down often doing the show, but that's okay.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I know. I think we all of us activists are sort of swimming in these horrible realities, and it's hard enough to get through the day when you think about all the suffering out there. But so anyway, I didn't mean to bring you down. And I actually, it's important that you brought this up, because when I go and speak to audiences, I try to make sure, at least it's my intent, to make sure that every audience knows that I do not intend to be a fearmonger. I don't think this law is something to be scared of. I think it's something to be aware of. I don't want to be part of the silencing of the animal rights movement by putting this book out and by having people read it. So the fact that you were left with this grim reality in the end, I regret that. Maybe I should have put something a little more upbeat in the end and a little more inspiring. I think we should all speak louder, because our voices are being silenced and muffled in the sense, and we should get out there and do more. We have to do more. I don't think people should be fearful of this law. I just think they should be aware of it. And I think they should get out there and again, speak loudly on behalf of animals and just know the law. That's all. It's, you know, 25, 30 years ago, animal activism was different. We just went out there and we, to the extent that you had to, you would worry about low-level property crimes, vandalism or trespassing on the state level. You know, now it's a different ballgame. Now you worry about the federal prosecution and the federal crime of terrorism. And Peter Young has spoken to this at conferences. Statistically speaking, your chances of getting caught for doing something are very, very small, because based on the number of animal liberation actions, if you compare that to how many prosecutions there actually were, it's very statistically insignificant. That being said, I would urge people just to know the law and know what's legal and what's not legal and what the risks are, and then choose accordingly, choose actions accordingly. But I don't think that our movement should be silenced or let this law silence us at all. And I think we need to get out and prove to be more resistant against these industries. Even if we can't get this law repealed, it's going to be out there, that's fine. We just speak more loudly so that our voices are heard.
Tara, do you have a website that you can point our listeners to, or would you just recommend they go to the Lantern Books website?
I would recommend you go to muzzlingamovement.com, and that's the title of the book, www.muzzlingamovement.com. And I have resources there, some links, and you can buy the book from that link, and it would take you to Lantern's website. And if I'm coming to a conference and speaking, you can buy the book for me, too. And, I would refer you there. And there are so many great websites out there that have a lot of interesting information about this. And I know you've had other great speakers. I'm not saying I'm great. I'm saying you've had other speakers, and they have to be great, come on your show and talk about different ideas of activism. And there's so much great information out there on the internet, and I really encourage everybody who doesn't know just to go out there and do some of the Googling. Get informed.
Get your Google on. Dara, yeah. I want to thank you for putting out this book, because it's very, very straightforward. It breaks down these fairly complicated legal issues into very straightforward language that I think anybody out there who's listening, you don't need to be a legal scholar to understand the issues that are being raised in here. As well, the book has a few different appendices of the actual wording of the laws and a chart state by state of some of the laws. Protective animal enterprises, it has a bibliography that even the bibliography alone is worth checking out. So I highly recommend the book. And I really enjoyed reading it. So thank you very much for all the work that you've done in doing this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on, and your words mean a lot to me, and your opinion means a lot to me, so I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye.
We were just speaking with Dara Lovitz, author of Muzzling a Movement, The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money, and Politics on Animal Activism, and this has been another episode, sounds strange to call it that, but another edition of Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Again, if you want to check out this show or our 300 plus other archived programs, do check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, drop us a line, animalvoices@gmail.com. Coming up next, as usual, some hot jams.